on the phoenix throne in her nightgown. If any of the guards turned, they'd catch sight of her sacred collarbones, her delicate ankles, her pearl toenails. Each lock of unbound hair is a brushstroke against her pale skin. Yes, if the guards turned now, they'd see Oshizuka glowing. She's been known to do it on occasion. It is a soft glow, no brighter than a candle, but it wraps around her like a cloak. No one dares mention it to her. No one mentions the Empress's mangled ear. Of course no one mentions how she sometimes becomes a paper lantern. It is their little secret. Their confirmation that, for all her temper and her arrogance, Oshizuka's blood runs gold with divinity. For they have all seen it. When she's angry, it takes sharp shapes. When she's excited, the aura stands on end. But it is there, and it is especially visible now in the dark, the most visible it has ever been. The Empress is glowing. After no more than an hour's time, the messenger returns. He scrambles through the great doors alone and falls to his knees. "The others?" asks Oshizuka. "They are following Imperial Majesty," he says. "One of them carries a phoenix feather." Oshizuka rises. The air tastes different. Like milk, she thinks. Like fermented milk and horses. Like the cutting cold winds of the steppes. Her heart drops to her knees. Her breath leaves her for some distant land. She runs. Bare feet meet cold tile. Yes, she can feel it now. The painful thrumming in her chest. Her lungs burning. Her whole being vibrating at once. And when Oshizuka throws open the doors to the palace, when she gazes upon the expansive courtyard and the gardens her ancestors built, she has eyes only for one. Bare feet against stone. First bell rings inside the palace. The sky above is rich with stars, each one the soul of an honorable person, each one looking on in envy as the two lovers are reunited. For yes, there is Barsalia Shefali, wearing her tiger-striped deal. Strapped to her back is the bow no man can fire. Her left eye is a steel peony covered in filmy black. Hanging from a cord around her neck is the laughing fox mask. An iridescent phoenix feather is tucked behind her ear, though the feather pales in comparison to the laughing green of Shefali's right eye. And yes, she has changed a bit. Her full cheeks are hollowing out. Her warm brown skin is turning charcoal gray. Pointed ears peek out beneath her now dull blonde hair. And when she sees Oshizuka, when she smiles wide as the wall of stone, her teeth are all pointed. But it is Shefali all the same. Oshizuka runs into her wife's embrace. The rest can wait. Continue listening for more in the world of The Tiger's Daughter, an early found remnant of the unfinished memoir by the poet Prince Owitzki. Creature of Beauty, Creature of Truth. If in 20 years I die with Minami Shizuru at my side, then I wish for two things to be made known to the whole empire. First, I died happy. Second, I tried to talk her out of it. How easily she unravels me. In the fierce brilliance of her presence, even my finest poetry is the work of a lovesick novice. Worse, all these years I thought I wrote of brightly burning flame, when in truth I was writing only of the shadow cast by her absence, as yet unknown to me. It is my great sorrow that I heard of Minami Shizuru for the first time during the Korin War. Ah, but at what use my laments? The gods themselves cannot change the past to suit them. I am a fool for dwelling. There must be a reason I only heard of her then. I can tell you exactly where I was the first time I heard her name. 300 li from Fujino, nestled deep within the rolling hills of Hanjian. My brother and I were on our way to Oshiro, under order from my honored father. He and all his imperial pragmatism knew the people would care for us more if they saw us at the front lines. Iori could not contain his excitement. My brother, the crown prince, insisted on wearing his solid gold show armor and dragon helm at all times. Briefings in the war tent were no exception. There are lengths even I will not go to for aesthetic's sake. That helmet blinded the wearer to anything except that which was directly ahead of him. Supposedly, this was meant to be a metaphor. The Emperor looked only to the future. And though there is a time and place for metaphor, war is not it. Of course, I should not have expected anything different from Iori, who spent the majority of his time sparring with anyone who would have him. He was so inflated with his own glory that he didn't realize he won only because his opponents allowed him to. I stood to the right of my brother whenever I could, so that I would not have to look on his excited face whenever the reports of battle came in. On that day, we were the highest-ranking officers present, thanks to our prestigious berth and the fact that all the real commanders had already been sent to Oshiro. General Kobayashi of the East had been among them, and so she sent us one of her captains, a man named Sato, to inform us of the situation and keep us from charging headlong into danger. He wore unadorned armor, and the sword at his hip had come straight off the armory racks. The war mask hanging from its cord around his neck was a bog-standard wolf. In short, Sato was the exact opposite of my brother, and I loved him for it. A map lay spread out before us. A dozen or so figurines stood atop it, gathered in a half-circle near Oshiro Castle, facing out toward the wall of stone. The invading Quorum forces were represented by little wooden cubes. There weren't many of them, but they were positioned all over the province. Past the wall of stone, there were far more cubes, clustered close together near the hole. "Tell us the truth of it, old man. How will we turn the tide?" said Iori. He picked up the dragon figurine that represented us and used it to push the nearest cube, situated at the border with Hanjian, off the table. "That is where the leader is, isn't it? This is why we're attacking from this angle." Captain Sato, to his credit, did not react to this foolish display. "Their leader is here," he said, tapping a square much closer to the palace. "That was one of their smaller forces, Your Imperial Highness." "How many months can we maintain the siege?" I asked. I knew Oshiro Jinichi only in passing, but I knew his son Yuichi well. He'd come to Fujino to study law at great cost to his father. He was no warrior. I wondered how he felt, surrounded on all sides by attackers who would not listen to any of his elegant arguments. "Half a year given current conditions, Your Highness. Assuming General Watanabe's emergency barricades hold and the bulk of their forces do not reach the wall," said Captain Sato. He did not address whether or not the Quorum had any more explosives. "However..." He pushed one of the figurines north of the castle toward a cache of wooden cubes. "Captain Araya is attempting to liberate the river and surrounding areas." "Then we must go north," said Iori, banging on the table. "We will provide reinforcements to him and break the siege of Oshiro." Captain Sato's brow twitched. "Your Imperial Highness," he said, "I'm certain you know far more people than I will meet in my entire life, among them Captain Araya's father. But the captain I speak of now is his daughter. Her unit is quite far removed from this one. To join her, we would have to march through much of Uitsuki. It is much more efficient to flank the enemy from the south." Iori grimaced. Not yet on the battlefield, and his pride was already wounded. "Besides," said Captain Sato, "the Minami family is with Captain Araya." The name instantly conjured clouds of legend in my mind. The Minami family. Is there a fox woman among the Quorum? Ukuhara Ryuji, one of my childhood mentors, wrote a fine poem about Minami Shori's famous rescue of the first Emperor Yame. Most people remember it for its use of an all-new meter, but I remember the confrontation at its climax. In all the Empire, only Minami Shori has ever resisted the charms of a fox woman. "No one's seen a fox woman in centuries," sneered my brother. It was a silly thing to say. Toy dragons should not question old soldiers. I regretted my words immediately. But it was then that Captain Sato finally let out something like a laugh. "Even if the enemy had a squad full of demons, I would not worry. Minami Shizuru would cut right through them." "Yes, her." Captain Sato said her name as if he were a small boy bragging about the strength of his father. This hardened veteran spoke of her in such a way. Hearing her name soon became a familiar song. Captain Araya broke the siege of Oshira within the week, and all reports sang the praises of Minami Shizuru. A woman too poor to afford a proper horse, she rode a mule, had unseated expert Korn riders. A woman who wore smelly armor at least 2 generations old continued to fight in spite of her injuries, fiercer than ever. A woman who had the unbelievable audacity to feed crows whenever she encountered them, thinking of it only as a good luck charm. Crows. Most refused to go near those ominous birds, and yet she often started her morning seeking them out with her excess rations. But my favorite thing about her was that she didn't want to be there any more than I did. My father had forcibly enlisted her, and all of her siblings. He'd called on their oath of fealty, knowing full well they had nothing else to offer save their own service. A single soldier's paltry salary would have been a blessing to them, let alone 6. How could they refuse? Alas, half the other Minami children had already fallen. Eldest brother Goro was found face down on the field with 6 arrows in his back. Masaru, the middle brother, sustained a nasty leg wound while riding in the cavalry, which soon soured his blood. Only her brother Keichi, youngest of the Minami boys, survived to accompany her that day. If Shizuru was a beacon, Keichi was only a paper lantern. Lack of charisma was his plague. He lacked the heroic bearing that made Shizuru so popular, and lacked the braggadocio that made her controversial. No one could remember any details about him. Indeed, when Shizuru asked who among the army would stay with her after Captain Araya had called for a treat, Keichi was the first to answer. Everyone agreed on that, yet not a soul could remember what he said. And yet, I could not imagine vouching for Iori in such a way. My own brother proved my misgivings during our first battle, a smallish skirmish 2 days after Captain Araya broke the siege. Again, he insisted on that ostentatious armor, despite the arrows flying through the air and screams of the dying all around us. One of those arrows landed in his side, and then it was his voice screaming. A memory from our childhood tuned to the present. Bright gold is no bulwark against sharp stone and wood. It took 5 heartbeats for me to realize anything had gone wrong. I had heard the sound, the wet thump next to me, but I did not really believe we could be hurt, not until I saw Iori swaying in his saddle. My mouth went dry. We were in the center of a storm, the two of us, thundering hooves, whistling arrows cracking against shields, swords crashing against armor. None of this was real. None of it could be. I was the poet prince, second to the crown, playing war games with my brother. Iori, wan and glassy-eyed, rivers of red spilling from his veins over the famed imperial gold. I must be Minami Keichi, I thought, though he is no Shizuru. And so I rode to him, and I pulled him onto my saddle, and I broke off the arrow shaft with my bare hands. Then I wrapped his arms around me as best I could, and galloped back to camp. I will remember always the fallen in my path. Men and women I'd sat with around a fire now lay at my feet gasping for breath. More than one grabbed at my horse as I ran past, or shouted for me to stop. Some rasped my name. There is nothing, nothing so haunting as a look in a dying man's eyes when he realizes you are not going to save him, when he realizes you will not even give him the dignity of his final drink of water. Here he has fallen. Without 8 coins for the mother, here he will stay, his spirit forever bound to the field of rot. How many centuries would it be before someone found his forsaken bones and gave him the proper rites? By the time I reached the surgeon's tent, I was trembling like the last leaf of spring in autumn. As soon as the surgeons took my brother away, I emptied my stomach. And that was the first battle. There were 2 more before we reached the front, but my brother's injury precluded him from fighting. Iori spent those weeks recovering. I do not think it's shameful of me to say I was too afraid to return to the front lines. I was not born to be a soldier. Instead, I spent my time at my brother's side, bleeding out my fears onto whatever scraps of paper I could find. Mind, it was not good writing, but I was trying at least. Why did we get stuck with these cowards? Iori complained. If we had the Minami woman with us, we'd already be at the White Palace. Her name sounded wrong on his tongue, as if it were a foreign word he had not yet mastered, and not the name of the Empire's oldest vassal family. And if you were Yuzuki the Brawler, you could do it yourself. The gods have their plan, Iori. We are here and she is elsewhere, doing important work. He glared at me over his shoulder. Iori and I both have amber-colored eyes, but his are darker, meant for glaring and sneering. We are the princes of the whole empire. What could be more important than doing our bidding? I could not hide my frustration with him. We may be princes, but she is the queen of crows. Inspiration struck me as the arrow had struck Iori. Though I was seated, I staggered, swaying under the weight of this new idea. The image of Minami Shizuru walking in the mother's shadow, a crown of black feathers on her proud brow. My hand began writing, though the lines were not yet fully formed in my mind. For the first time in what felt like an eternity, I was alight with passion. This, I thought, was going to be different from anything I'd written before. These lines would be spare and unflinching. Instead of toying with meter, as I so often did, here I would pray at its altar. Instead of dwelling on the beauty of nature, I would turn my lens toward the frantic chaos of war. And the woman who cut through it the way her sword cut through flesh. Iori, of course, did not share my vision. "I don't know why I bother talking to you about anything important," he said. I paid him no mind. The poem was already forming. Within it, I would find my solace, my comfort. Even if the Quorn pillaged this camp, then so long as this poem survived, I would live on. 2 weeks after that last battle, the very day I finished the first full version of the poem, we received word that the war was over. Oshiro Yuichi, son of Genichi and the future lord of the province, was to be given in marriage to the Quorn war leader Burkila. Bringing Oshiro and the steps together in such a way would help smooth relations, was the thinking. And no one could say Yuichi was an unsuitable husband. Even then, he was known for his essays on legal matters. More than once, he'd been called on to tutor my brother. Who could reject a lord, a scholar, and a friend to the crown? By Hokkaran standards, Burkila's marriage was enviable indeed. But she would, of course, have to pay a price for it. No woman could be both the Lady of Oshiro and the Grand Karsa. Thus, she would renounce the latter title. All of the Quorn remaining in Oshiro would return to the steppes within a week. Her firstborn child would be born in the Empire, to be raised by Oshiro Yuichi. Yet there was a mutual promise in that agreement, at least. After all, just as no Quorn would dare to attack a child of Burkila Alshara, no Hokkaran child would dare to attack their own mother. For the next three generations, all of Burkila's lineage would be both Quorn and Hokkaran for all rights and purposes, and thus free from Hokkara's conquering grasp. It was a wise deal on both accounts, but especially on Burkila Alshara's. That was the trick of it, the trick of her. She was as canny as any courtier. If Quorn was her first language, and Hokkaran her second, then negotiation was surely her third. This was the woman who somehow persuaded the merchant prince of Shoshar to provide her with wagons full of dragon's fire. This was the woman who established a system of messengers much faster than our own. This was the woman who sought out engineers as eagerly as she sought out soldiers. She knew precisely what she was doing, and this deal was emblematic of her forward-thinking nature. Burkila knew the limits of her people and could read the currents of war. My father was going to throw army after army at her, and she had only 3,000 within the wall. Better to surrender now than risk losing so many. And so as her people returned to the steppes, she stayed behind in Oshiro with her new husband, a man she did not know and certainly did not care for. Still, it was a fate she accepted without reservation, so long as her people were safe. Anything to keep the peace. But it was an uneasy peace at best. Many of the returning soldiers felt there was unfinished business between them and the Quorn, debts that could only be paid in blood. Though no one called for an invasion of the steppes, they found other ways to release their tension. While I was sitting in a tea house in the city, I myself witnessed the end result. Five former soldiers came over to a darker-skinned man and spat out all sorts of vitriol. As far as they were concerned, he was spying for the enemy. His mother was a horse, and he needed to return to his own country. Now, this man wore Hokkaran clothes, and he was drinking Hokkaran tea in the Hokkaran capital. He had brown eyes, not green. Dark hair, not light. In short, there was nothing Khorne about him except for the color of his skin. But that was enough for these men. The man, for the most part, ignored his harassers. He sat by his table, with a young woman in Xianese clothing. She squirmed in her seat, leaning over every so often and whispering to him. The moment one of the soldiers grabbed him, I knew I couldn't just sit idly by. I commanded my bodyguard to break up the fight. But to my horror, half the tea house was in support of the soldiers. The only solution was to shut the whole thing down until the city guard picked up the rowdy soldiers. I stayed the whole time. If I was present, and all those involved knew I was present, then the situation would not escalate again to the physical. But there are many ways to hurt a person, and though I endeavor to do the best I can, I am only one man, and a far removed one at that. What did I know, really, about the sort of struggles displaced Khorne were going through? I'd never gone hungry a day in my life. Few people so much as disliked me. How could I know? More importantly, how could I help? I attempted to bring the issue to my father's attention, but it was no use. Any Khorne blood made Hokkara weaker in his eyes. My brother agreed with him. It was no use arguing with them. And so I decided I did not need them. My poetry has won me friends in many circles. I called upon those connections then, forming a covert network within Fujino. There were roughly 300 Khorne within the province per the last census. A large number, certainly, but only a small percentage of Fujino's many thousand residents. We would only need to cast a small net. Lawyers were our first targets. Whenever a Khorne, or someone mistaken for one, was arrested on trumped-up charges, an exceptionally expensive attorney would materialize out of thin air to defend them. Sometimes all those allegations fell away the moment our lawyers turned up. Sometimes they didn't. Either way, our clients had the best defense I could afford. Next, doctors and surgeons. No healers. As despite reports to the contrary, the Imperial Treasury has its limits. Still, a good doctor could serve an entire community, and it was their attention I sought. Some physicians in Fujino refused to serve anyone darker than sackcloth, and my father had done little to discourage them. So, whenever I heard tell of someone doing this, I added another doctor to my payroll and promptly sent them over. Food, too, was important. Thankfully, it was also both the cheapest to acquire and the easiest to distribute. All it took in that case was a network that ran from the Imperial kitchen out onto the streets and into eager hands. I do not want to sound as if I fixed the problem single-handedly. I did not, and surely all of my efforts would have been in vain if not for the contributions of hundreds of others. Doing my best to help brought me comfort and gave me something to focus on besides the war. I asked for nothing more than this. In my other hours, I chained myself to the page, rewriting and editing Queen of Crows. More than anything, I tried to convey the senselessness of the Khorne War, the despondency. I told the entire story as plainly as I could. 700 lines of spare metaphor and cold truth. By the time I released the thing, it had drained me of all my life and energy in the best possible way. Within 2 days, I received my first letter from one of my old calligraphy instructors. Ukuhara Ryuji's hand was widely considered the finest in the empire at the time. The letter was as brief as it was cutting. I wish you'd sent me only the 100 lines about Minami Shizuru. You are a creature of beauty. Bleakness does not suit you. It hurt, of course, and then there was no one to discuss it with. If I told Iori that my latest work was ill-received, he'd never let me hear the end of it. My father didn't even bother listening to me whenever I spoke about it. So there I sat, those 2 lines cutting through my stomach lining, my guts spilling out for all to see. It couldn't be true, could it? Perhaps that was just his opinion. Perhaps others who had seen things I'd seen would appreciate it. But every day more letters came in deriding the thing. Each one another needle in my flesh. It seemed this poem I'd been so enamored with was little more than an amateur's scribbling. Everyone seemed to agree that this was my worst work yet, with one equally unanimous exception, the depiction of that glorious warrior. My readers delighted in her. In letter after letter, they commended me for capturing such a perfect image of that noble heroine, Minami Shizuru. Other poets seized that title, that imagery, and ran with it. By the end of that year, there were at least 100 works about the Queen of Crows. Yet, no one wanted to listen to me talk about my fear or my sadness, or my experiences at war. Only my longing for love interested them, only my observations on nature and beauty. To know that something which had brought me such comfort met with such derision, it was as if the whole nation had watched me bleed before them, and not a single one offered to help. I was reminded, in the cruelest way, of the dying I'd seen at war, of the haunting look in their eyes. Dwelling on that memory left a sour taste in my mouth, no matter how relatable I found the image. A metaphor means nothing if it is misused. Who would dream of arguing that my suffering equaled that of a dying soldier's? No, I knew my place. This was ill-received poetry. I would live to write another day. But to make matters worse, my father then fell ill. It was all very gradual, unexplained aches and pains, until the day he collapsed, howling in agony while entertaining Doenjiro. From that moment on, the prognosis was dire. Healers are capable of any number of minor miracles, but in this instance, there was only so much they could do. The poison in my father's blood would keep returning, over and over. Any procedures he underwent now would only prolong the inevitable. And so he chose to die. Iori took it well. He began lording over the palace staff the moment our father told us of his decision. My brother strutted like a peacock down the endless halls, pronouncing to anyone who would listen all the things he'd change once he was emperor. It was not long before he got his chance. My father passed away in his sleep 2 days before the beginning of Nishin. I cannot say I was especially sad to see him go. The world would not lament the passing of Emperor Yorihito. His legacy, 8 academies and a war, would long outlive him. But during his last few days, it was difficult to look at him without falling into despair. My father rode in General Izuri's army to conquer Shanglai. He was hale and hearty, well into his old age. Yet the man who lay in bed before me was a withered husk. Even the most anemic branch of bamboo would be thicker than his arms. Gone was his trip-wired mind. He could no longer recognize either of his sons. All my life he'd bragged of Iori's physical talents and my mental ones. But in the end he was silent and still. I did not miss the emperor, but I would miss the man who raised me. Despite miming his filial duty for years, Iori did not mourn. Our father's body was not yet cold the first time Iori donned the dragon crown. Oh, he made a show of attending funerary services, but it was not hard to see the aura of joy about him. His first decree was that for all rites and purposes, our father died on the first of Nishin. Dying in Tokar was too much of an ill omen. A coronation would go no better. He was right on that account. Ascending the throne during the brother's month would cast a shadow on his reign that death itself could not banish. In Hokkara, where omens mean everything, it was best to err on the side of safety. Wise, even. His second proclamation was more in line his previous bouts of stupidity. A tournament to find the 16 finest warriors in the land, who would then march beyond the Wall of Flowers to slay the traitor. This was, to any Hokkaran, a just and righteous thing to do. The traitor's foul creations were beginning to break through the Wall of Flowers. Shiseki faced the worst of it, beset by demon attacks and the Black Blood Plague alike. Yet, there were other signs throughout the 8 provinces. Shiratori's famed caverns full of gems were collapsing at an astonishing rate. Oshiro's golden fields returned smaller harvests every passing year. Livestock throughout the empire were dying well before their time. That this was the traitor's doing was not a matter for debate. All the theologians in the empire were in perfect agreement. Yet, a force of 16 heroes, mortal men and women, to slay a god. And he mocked me for being obsessed with stories. It boggled my mind. Did he think it would work? Or did he, like our father before us, believe in the spectacle of the thing more than its efficacy? I will give him a little credit. The tournament served as a fine distraction from the nation's grief. A gathering of warriors renowned for their skill, dueling for the honor of saving the empire. A fine plot for a novel, and a finer one to see play out before your very eyes. Though it cost an astronomical sum to put on, the tournament also drew crowds from all over the empire. Forced to attend his little show, I told myself that I might see something inspiring, but my heart was not in it. Inspiration was a distant memory. Until, on the fifth day of competition, my eyes at last fell upon her face. At first, I had no idea who she was. Her opponent was Sugihara Gendo, who in any other era would go down as the most famous duelist of his time. Sugihara stood close to our viewing platform and was announced far earlier than his opponent. When she walked out onto the field, when I first saw her, it was as if I had awoken from a long dream, as if nothing prior to that moment mattered. Who was this woman, cloaked in rough-spun robes humbled even by a monk's standards? Who was this woman with a shaggy lion's mane of unbound hair? Though she stood in front of thousands of civilians and the emperor himself, she held a pipe in her hand, curls of smoke coming up out of it. I found myself leaning forward as she walked to the center of the field, where Sugihara Gendo awaited her. She took a drag from her pipe before stashing it away within her chest pocket. "Ara, we've got a crowd," she shouted, so loud and clear that I heard her without issue despite the distance. "Who is this boar?" Yori asked. The city's governor, Kahai Junpei, who was in charge of the tournament and all the lists, shared our platform. He did not need to check his records. Indeed, he could not hide a smile. "That," he said, "is the Queen of Crows herself, Minami Shizuru." My heart fell to my stomach. That was the woman I'd written about? How I wish I'd met her before I started writing. The woman before me was a staunch iconoclast, and I'd cast her as the height of Hokkaido monarchy. I had to laugh. After this duel was over, I was going to have to track her down and apologize. "All right, you lot," she said. "Who do you think is going to win this match? Me or Gendo Cole over there?" Gendo Cole? As if he were a scholar or a smith. I could not tell if she meant to insult him or if she simply didn't care which honorific she used. Either way, I was entranced. Other competitors boasted, but none were as charismatic as she was. Her friendly country accent coupled with her relaxed posture made it easy to forget she was such a war hero. I leaned forward, my eyes wide, my heart pounding. The crowd erupted into cheers. It was hard to make out any particular winner with all the shouting. But the moment Minami Shizuru waved them off, the whole crowd went quiet. "They're excited, Gendo Cole. What do you say we make this more interesting, hmm? Every time I hit you, you've got to buy one of my famous bamboo mats." "Bamboo mats," sneered my brother. "She can't be serious." "She is," said Kahai. "Haven't you heard of Minami bamboo mats? They've been selling them for the last 5 years." I laughed again, louder and harder than I had since the war. Bamboo mats. I knew of the Minami clan's financial troubles, but bamboo mats of all things. Sugihara was also laughing. "Then I shall walk away without a single mat," he called. Next to Minami Shizuru, everything about him was stiff and old-fashioned, including his accent. "And what of you? For each blow of mine, what do you offer?" Minami Shizuru grinned. I could not remember the last time I saw a noble grin in public. "Don't be so cocky," she said. "How's this? If you can hit me even once, I'll run an entire lap around the palace, naked as the gods made me." Sugihara did not hesitate. "Accepted," he said. He drew a sword and Minami Shizuru followed suit, except that she wielded nothing more than a wooden training sword. I could not believe my eyes. A wooden training sword against Sugihara Gendo. How was she going to parry with that thing? And yet, I watched, flabbergasted, as she dodged his most expert strokes. That woman turned herself to water right there in the arena. How else to explain the fluidity of her movement? One moment she was a laughing brook, swaying away from his sword. The next, she was falling rain landing blows on his arms and shoulders. All the while she was grinning, laughing, teasing him. When she ended the duel by breaking his nose, it was a mercy to the man's reputation. In the end, Sugihara Gendo bought no less than 50 bamboo mats, and no one saw Minami Shizuru naked. Of course, of the 5 more duels she made the same wager, the results never changed. 50 mats sold, and not a lap taken. The winners of the tournament received 10,000 ryo each, but at this rate, she was going to win that purse solely through selling mats. And all this with a wooden sword. Where was the Minami clan's fabled daybreak blade? That, too, I longed to see in person, though watching the endlessly entertaining Shizuru was its own reward. Kahai informed me that Shizuru and her brother traded the sword each day they were in competition. Where is he competing, then? I asked. There were 8 arenas spread throughout the city, though obviously the palace courtyard was the most prestigious. I'd seen Ketchy dispatch 2 street thugs at once on the 3rd day, now that I thought of it, and he was using the wooden sword. He was impressive, but he lacked his sister's effortless charisma. Out in the Haravana district, said Kahai. An hour's walk, and Minami Shizuru was not yet done for the day. As I looked out at her taking drags from her pipe, I knew without a doubt who I would rather watch. I called for paper and brush, and then for someone to carry my letter. To this day I remember it. Minami Shizuru, 8,000 apologies for misrepresenting you. I admit, I should have waited to write that poem until we met. Your true self is far more interesting than my lines. Before you, I am as awestruck and speechless as a schoolboy. Will you allow me the honor of your company after your final match of the day? May the fallen sun favor you today. Owitzki. I watched the servant run out from our platform, watched her weave through the crowds to reach the Queen of Crows. I watched her tear open the letter without a wink of care for the expensive paper. I tried to search her expression for any hint of her reaction, but it was difficult to do as far apart as we were. Sweat trickled down the back of my neck. She flipped over the letter, shouted at someone for a brush, and scrawled something back. I was so eager to read it, I stood and walked to the edge of our viewing platform, that I might receive it heartbeats earlier. Her handwriting was as rough and untamed as the rest of her. Some of those characters were so badly done, they'd paint a scholar scarlet. But I loved them. Who else would dare to send me such a thing? It was so honest. Poet Prince, the price for my company is 50 mats and 2 bottles of plum wine. Afterward, if I like you, it'll be 25 mats and a single bottle. Impress me. The queen of drinking you under the table. Needless to say, it was a price I was more than happy to pay. That night, Minami Shizuru introduced me to a tea house the city guard didn't dare go near. White leaf, white smoke. She did so on the condition that I keep a hat pulled over my face the whole time, and that I dismiss my bodyguards. And should I be attacked by an assassin, I wondered, whoever shall protect me? Are you as dumb as you are pretty? Minami Shizuru replied. She smelled of smoke and sweat and wine and leather. It's your brother they're after. Everyone in the Empire loves you. Do you count as everyone, Minami-sun? I said. There was an ease to being around her. I did not have to try so hard. She did not expect metaphors to drop out of my mouth as easily as honorifics. She pulled the pipe out again, offering a quick glimpse of her scandalous tattoo, and bit down on the stem. Even so, she was smirking. That is a question, isn't it? Though I badgered her to expand, to confirm one way or the other, I soon discovered her fluidity also extended to conversation. She turned my inquiry into a question about Yuzuki the Brawler, or my inspirations, or my opinion on whatever painted opera the Fujino Theater Company was putting on. From there, we'd branch out, like a river, into any number of conversations. By the time I walked her to a room at a local inn, it was nearly second bell, but I didn't care. I might have used all the luck in my life that night, for Shizuru agreed to see me a second evening, and then a third. And soon Minami Shizuru's presence became as essential to my nights as the moon, as the stars, as the breath in my lungs and the blood in my veins. Being with her, meeting her even once, was the culmination of my life till then. Every experience I'd had, every sorrow, every joy, had prepared me for her. The first time we kissed, I knew that I would ask her to marry me. I resolved to ask her one evening as the two of us sat in the white leaf, white smoke. Catchy was with us. I felt it was appropriate to have him there when I asked, in case he had any objections he wished to discuss with her. But fate, as I have said, is a cruel mistress, and she had other plans that day. As we sat together, the three of us sharing our first round, we noticed an outpouring of people coming from the back of the tea house. White leaf white smoke was packed more often than not. A spot near a table was a treasured thing to have. To see so many abandoning their hard-earned space did not bode well. Minami Ketchi sniffed. "I'll give it a look," he said before setting off to do just that. Shizuru finished her cup. "Better not be any problems," she said. "I like this place too much to see it shut down." I followed Ketchy with my eyes. The rough-cut crowd parted for him, for the most part, though he wore the wooden sword at his belt and not the daybreak blade. "I'm certain it's nothing," I said. "Perhaps there was a spill." When Ketchy returned to us, his face was hard. There was simmering anger in his brown eyes, thick ropes of tension flowing down his neck. "It's her," he said.
"Who is her?" Shizuru asked. "Ketchy, don't be an idiot. Say what you mean or don't say anything at all. I don't know why I have to keep..."
"It's the wall breaker." My blood froze. Burkila Alshara. No one was particularly happy to see her competing in the tournament. Yet, no one could deny that she was one of the finest warriors alive. I'd missed her inaugural match due to a few of Shizuru's distractions, but I'd heard about it after the fact. She'd shown up on horseback. Quorum customs being what they are, she must have thought it would be acceptable. The judges demanded that she dismount per the terms of the tournament. After a tense, albeit polite, argument with her interpreter, she agreed. Her opponent was a young man with a polearm who stained his trousers at the sight of her. When he charged her, she kicked him in the leg, pulled the polearm out of his hands, and bashed him over the head with it. As he lay bleeding onto the arena, she pulled a slate and chalk from her chest pocket.
"Are you going to deny the hole in your wall, too, or only my skill?"
Like Shizuru, she took everything we'd come to expect from honorable combat and turned it upside down. Unlike Shizuru, Burkila Alshara was responsible for the deaths of hundreds of Hokkaran civilians and 1,000 soldiers, likely more on both accounts. And now she was sitting here in a tea house in Fujino, surrounded by veterans who hated her more than they hated the traitor himself, having a cup of warm fermented milk.
"I'm going to give her a piece of my mind," said Shizuru. "Who does she think she is coming here?"
"No," said Ketchy. "We don't want to fight, Zuru, not here. If we get kicked out of this tournament, what are we going to do?"
"This is more important than the money," said Shizuru,
which was the first time I'd heard her so much as hint at anything of the sort. She was already on her feet. My heart sank into my throat as I realized she had one hand on the daybreak blade. "Shizuru," I said, standing and following along after her. "Think about what you're doing. She's not your enemy anymore. She's not hurting anyone."
"She's hurt enough people already," said Shizuru.
And by then we saw her. And as with Shizuru, the wall breaker looked nothing like I imagined she would. Instead of a hardened woman in her 40s, covered in scars and the hint of coming wrinkles, I saw a girl at least 10 years my junior. The baby fat clinging to her cheeks undermined the small scars pockmarking her brown skin. Instead of a pampered Hokkaran's finery, she wore a practical green coat in the Korin style,
embroidered with circles and squares in yellow thread. The coat intensified the viper green of her eyes, which now fixed us with silent expectation. Her eyes were the trick of it. The rest of her was young, but those eyes had seen much. All of a sudden, Shizuru burst into laughter.
"Which one of you idiots had the idea to prank me, hmm? Someone told my brother that the demon of the steps is here. You people think all corn look the same."
Ketchy, who had followed along after us, put a hand on his sister's shoulder. "Shizuru, that's..." Shizuru didn't listen. As bold as ever, she pointed to the young corn woman with the sheathed daybreak blade.
"That's a child," she said, "who wandered off her mother's teat."
I loved the woman, but at that moment I was absolutely certain she was about to start a war. Yet, how does one stop a hurricane once it's made landfall? The best I could do was stand at her side and pull her away if she tried anything. All eyes fell to the corn woman. She pulled slate and chalk from her pocket. That was when I knew, without a doubt, that this was not going to be a good night. Burkila Alshara was famously mute, apparently. This was all the confirmation of identity that Shizuru needed. She shoved the daybreak blade back into her belt and launched herself across the table before I could get a hold of her. Time slowed like ice creeping through lake water as I saw my future wife punch Burkila Alshara square in the nose. There was one wet pop, and then a moment of perfect silence, and then the explosion. The other patrons tasted blood in the water. Soon, two-thirds of those who remained in the teahouse started swinging at one another. Cups and pots flew through the air, shattering, sending shards careening through the room. I held up my arm to shield myself as much as I could. Burkila Alshara was no exception. She grabbed Shizuru's wrist, rose, and with one hand on Shizuru's back, shoved her right into the wall. To my horror, Shizuru bounced backwards from the force of the blow. Blood ran down her chin from her now split lip, glistening red as moist fruit. But Shizuru was not yet finished. She tackled Burkila Alshara with enough force to send the two of them tumbling to the ground. This was the worst thing she could have possibly done. Hokarin wrestling was to corn wrestling as a wooden sword was to the daybreak blade. And though it was not so noticeable when she was seated, Burkila Alshara was at least two heads taller than Minami Shizuru. Thus, the moment Shizuru took them to the ground, Burkila Alshara wrapped her long arms around Shizuru's shoulder and leg, and then stood up with Shizuru slung around her shoulders like a sack of millet.
"Shizuru,"
I shouted. "Stop this. You need to let it go. This isn't a proper duel with rules."
"I'm not a proper woman,"
she shouted, still stretched across Burkila's back, mind you. To her credit, Burkila did not continue the fighting until my little outburst was through. But as soon as Shizuru finished her boast, Alshara fell backwards, breaking the table with Shizuru's body, only to be confronted with a knee to the kidney. "Get the magistrates," I said to Ketchy.
"I'm not leaving her. You get them,"
he said. I gritted my teeth. I, too, could not bear to leave her. Yet, there was no doubt someone needed to get help. I broke off for a moment to find the teahouse matron, who was hiding beneath a shelf of pots. She was the one I sent out to get the guard. As I spoke to her, the crashing behind me continued. Shizuru's pained groans heralded the slap of flesh against flesh. By the time I looked back, Shizuru was on top again. Any hope I had to see her triumph was soon dashed. Burkila rocked forward, scooped up Shizuru's arm, and twisted. In that moment, I learned that broken arms sounded very much like broken twigs. She screamed, cursed, rolled off Burkila. I was at her side in an instant, holding her hand, doing whatever I could to ease the pain. Sweat left a thin sheen on her body. Her lips were dry and chapped. Next to us, Burkila Alshara knelt and wrote on her slate. I glanced up to see what she had to say for herself.
"You should have submitted, old woman, before I had to break your arm."
I scowled. The worst thing was, she was right. Shizuru must have realized on her own. She, too, glanced over at the slate, and then she lay back down, laughing.
"Yeah," she said. "You might be right about that."
Behind us, I heard the marching of imperial boots. barked orders to disperse followed not long after. The guards were coming, and yet Burkila Al-Sharr did not run. As Ketchy did his best to cobble together a splint for his sister's arm, Burkila Al-Sharr scrounged up a plank of wood to help him. I frowned. What was she getting at?
Itzki, said Shizuru.
I turned my attention to her instead of the warlord helping us.
Next time I try to fight a Khorne, you talk me out of it.
I winced. I tried, I said, but you are an arrow in flight. She laughed at that, too. In the haze of her injuries, she gestured to Al-Sharr, of all people.
Listen to him, she said. Arrow in flight, my poet.
Burkila did not have time to react. The guards by then were on us. Without so much as asking what had happened, they seized Burkila. Apologies to Shizuru fell from their mouths like leaves from autumn trees. Shizuru squinted.
Where are you taking her?
What sort of question was that?
To prison,
said one of the guards. Shizuru lurched up, yelping as she inadvertently put weight on her now broken arm.
Wait, wait, she said. I started this fight. You take her, you've got to take me too, and I've got the feeling you don't want to take me in.
I could not believe what I was hearing. She was lobbying for Burkila's freedom. Burkila Al-Sharr, the warlord. Even the woman herself raised a skeptic brow. The guard looked to me for confirmation. I cleared my throat. With all due respect, I said, it's true. Minamizul started the fight. However, I faltered, for I could not bring myself to use my power in so corrupt a manner. The guard must have caught on to the situation from my awkward silence.
Well, there's been a lot of property damage here, Your Imperial Highness, she said. Someone ought to pay for it.
Of course, I said. I could already see the list of damages forming, and it would be longer than I was tall. Rest assured, it will be taken care of.
You heard him, said Shizuru. Let her go. She won a fight, damn it. Isn't that why we're all here? To win fights.
Her voice was a little slurred from all the head injuries, but I got the feeling she'd make the same argument lucid. That was the most worrisome part of all. The guards released Burkila. That fearsome warrior stood a horse lengths away from us, unsure of how to hold herself or what to say. After a long silence, the captain bowed to us and departed. In doing so, she snapped the tension of the moment like twine, and the rest of us were free to resume breathing.
"Hey, Burkila," said the concussed woman in my arms. "Teach me how to do that arm-breaking thing when you get a chance, yes?"
After all that fighting, that was what Shizuru wanted to say to her. A smile broke out across Burkila's face, like sunlight through storm clouds. She nodded. And as we sat in the wreckage of the white-leaf, white-smoke teahouse, I thought to myself that it was a good thing I did not ask for Shizuru's hand that day. For one thing, that hand was mostly useless at the moment. And for another, with an introduction like that, there was no way Burkila Al-Sharr was going to end up anything but Minami Shizuru's greatest friend. A scant 2 days after this incident, I asked Minami Shizuru to marry me at the Imperial Gardens beneath my favorite dogwood tree. To my delight, she agreed. I was to be proven wrong on the first account. Shizuru fought a great many of her most famous duels with her broken arm in a sling after we got her to a surgeon. The woman outright refused going to a healer. As she put it, she didn't want to be responsible for wasting several thousand ryo and 10 years of someone's life over a broken arm. I should have expected nothing less from a woman who laughed in the face of death. But I was right on the second account. After that confrontation, Burkila and Shizuru's respect for one another only continued to grow. Soon, whenever we traveled, it was the three and one of us, Ketchy, Shizuru, Burkila, and myself. Sometimes the two of them ran off together on some madcap adventure they'd later refused to explain between tear-stained bouts of laughter. Burkila made good on her promise to teach Shizuru Khorne wrestling, and Shizuru paid her with lessons in barehanded fishing. Or tried to, anyway. It turned out Perkela had never been more than knee-deep in any water at all. The fact that fearsome Perkela could not swim brought Shizru endless joy. It took 2 weeks of practice before Perkela could so much as doggy paddle. Sitting on the banks of the Jade River, watching the wall-breaker herself flounder in the water, Shizru leaned on my shoulder with a grin. And it was hard not to smile along with her, with them. What a puzzling thing to behold, this newfound friendship. This woman who'd waged war on us took Shizru out riding and drinking. She let us try to draw her bow and laughed at us when Shizru could not hold it back for no more than a second. I admit, it did not feel quite right to me to be so trusting of a woman who'd tried to kill us. And yet, there was no end to Shizuru's enthusiasm for her. This is my favorite thing in the world about Minami Shizuru, my favorite even among a host of favorites. I will never, I think, fully understand my Queen of Crows. Our cores are too different. She is iron, and I am woven silk. We are strong in our own ways, but where I am soft, she is rough. Or perhaps she's the silk, for she is far more flexible than I, who hold on to my grudges. It is that difference that I yearn for. She is a puzzle I cannot figure out. She is a story with endless delightful little twists. Just when I think I've discovered all there is to know about her, she reveals something new. It was only after our daughter's birth, for instance, that Shizru admitted she was a fan of my poetry before we met. I asked her, incredulous, what she thought when she read my long-ago war poem. She tapped me on the nose. "You're pretty, and your words are too," she said. "But nothing you've ever written about me has been quite right." How many poems have I written about her? In some small way, she lives in everything I've written since we've met, for she is always on my mind. I suppose I will have to keep writing until I get it right. This has been an Audible Studios production of The Tiger's Daughter, written by K. Arsenault Rivera, performed by Caroline McLaughlin. Executive producers Ryan McGavin and Mike Charzik. Producer Neil Basic. Copyright 2017 by K. Arsenault Rivera. Sound recording copyright 2017 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.